Before we get started, I wanted to ask for a big favor. Yes, it's about ratings, reviews, and subscriptions. Those things make a huge difference when it comes to people discovering the podcast. So if you've enjoyed listening to Funded at all, please take 30 seconds to rate, review, and most importantly, subscribe wherever you listen.
I fly out to meet both Whitney Wolf Heard from Bumble and Serena Williams, pitch them in person, and they are my first two checks in, my first ever outside capital into the company.
This is Funded, a show where founders who raised millions in venture capital share the gritty side of what it actually took to get that money in the bank. I'm Jason Yeh. Not too long ago, I was trying to get my ideas funded. And back in the day, I was a VC listening to founders pitch me for money. A pregnancy, teaching 20 bar classes a week, booking commercials, and dancing at Knicks games. Those are just some of the things Erin Carpenter had to juggle during the 10 years before she was able to raise money for her business, Nude Bar, a tights and bodywear line that filled a gaping hole in the market. No one was making suitable shades for people of color. And that's where Erin came in. She's a professionally trained ballerina who for years had to stain tights and color her dance shoes with drugstore foundation to make them the right shade. Anyone who's ever looked at a Band-Aid and thought, well, that's not quite the right shade for me, knows there's a need here. But it took a decade for investors to catch on, and before then, a pretty big change in direction from her more creative ambitions as a kid.
As a child, I was generally always an entrepreneur or had an entrepreneurial spirit. So I was the kid that was like making bracelets and selling them to my friends. Or I remember one year my mom was like, oh, the local YMCA is having a swap meet. You know, maybe we should go to it. And I was like, oh, I could sell my used toys and get money for it. So I was always like in that mindset, like, I don't need these anymore. I'm 10 and those are for, I don't know, 6-year-olds or whatever. And I would just sell them at swap meets. So I started doing that every year as a thing. So I was always in that mindset of like monetizing on something, but I didn't really know like what that formal term was or what it meant or why I thought that way. It was just how I was, I guess.
Were your parents entrepreneurs?
No, my parents were not entrepreneurs at all. My wow. Mom is extremely risk adverse. like my life stresses her out every day. And, you know, I think in my dad's heart, he would like to be an entrepreneur. But I think just from, you know, the generation that they come from of being Black people in America and, you know, my parents were the first to go to integrated schools, like in their family. So a lot of their life was, you know, I just have to do the right thing and stay out of trouble and go to college. You know, they're the first generations to go to college in their families and to have like, you know, formal careers that aren't in hospitality or, you know, working for families, you know, in their homes and things of that nature. So I think the way that they were brought up was, you know, kind of in this perspective of let me get into corporate America, live corporate America life and just take all the right steps. But I think my dad kind of in his heart, that's not the guy that he is. So he really encouraged that spirit about me.
It's really interesting that you didn't see it, like you didn't have like a visual role model, but it was in you and you started doing that actually at such a young age. The next funny thing is that as I read about your background and we've talked before, you didn't actually continue down that path of, you know, selling your old toys and monetizing those things and you know, getting into business. Mm-hmm. It seems like you had a much more creative path. Can you tell me how your sort of life went down that direction as opposed to anything else?
Yeah. So, I mean, as a kid, I always wanted to be an entertainer. That was where my heart was. I've never really thought that much about the two being separate things, I guess, if like how you just broke it down. But yeah, I mean, I was always dancing in my living room or, you know, I loved pop music back, you know, when it was so new back then, like Janet Jackson and Madonna. Like I loved all of those people and I wanted to be those people. Like I wanted to, and I told my parents that every day, I want to be on stage. I want to do this. And I think because of their background and, you know, where they had gone in their careers, they were like, no, you know, why don't you do something else? And so they held off on putting me in the arts for a really long time because they didn't really see that as like a viable path of a career for me. So after you just begging them over and over again, year after year, they eventually did put me in dance classes. And so I actually started dance really late in life. I started around like 11 years old, 10, 11 years old, okay. Versus a lot of my friends had started at 3 years old, 4 years old. So I was way behind in the training. I like had to be in class with little kids for a year as like a 10, 11 year old, which is very strange. But I was so passionate about it. And I wanted to be in the arts.
Maybe you can sort of fast forward and talk a little bit about like your career progression and how it led you to Nude Bar.
Yeah. So I started Nude Bar when I was still dancing professionally. And really, you know, this had been a problem that was bugging me for years. So one of my first memories of solving the problem that I'm solving now at Nude Bar is that I got into, after being in the industry of training and dancing with the little kids in class and eventually getting to my proper level with my age group. And I got into a program at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C., where I grew up, that was in partnership with the Dance Theater of Harlem here in New York City. And so what the program looked like were that the principal dancers and artistic directors would come to D.C. at the Kennedy Center. 10 boys and 10 girls would be selected every year from the D.C., Virginia metropolitan area to be in this program. And you'd get free dance classes on Saturdays. You get to perform at the Kennedy Center on stage. It's very exciting, very competitive to get into. I got into this program when I was in high school. I was the new girl of that cohort. The other girls had been in it other years. And so I was so excited. This was like such an honor to get into this program. On the list of your, you know, uniform and your supplies, you had to have nude tights or flesh tone tights and flesh tone or nude shoes. So I go to the store, I buy these things that, you know, are labeled as nude or flesh tone. However, they're tan and they're beige. You know, they're lighter than me. They don't reflect my skin, my actual skin tone. But I thought, I read what was on the list. I purchased what it said on the label and the products in the stores. I show up to class. I'm asked to sit out of class at the beginning, like immediately, which is really embarrassing in this discipline of ballet or dance in general. If you're asked to sit out of class, it's usually that, you know, you didn't pay tuition, you're in trouble, or you showed up late, or you weren't in uniform. So, you know, either way, it, you know, equates to you did something wrong. So I asked the teacher at the end of class, after being so embarrassed and mortified, having to sit the full hour and a half in front of the classroom because I'm in trouble, you know, well, what was I supposed to do to be in uniform? What else could I have done? And she said, oh no, all the dancers here, they dye their tights and they either spray paint their dance shoes to be the brown that matches their skin, or you put makeup foundation onto your shoes, which in the industry is called pancaking. So this I learned through an embarrassing experience, and this became a part of my regimen for the rest of my career, because this is what it meant to be in true flesh tone or nude. And the point of this is that in ballet, let's just use that as one example, the tights and the shoes are pink. And ballet is a European art form, and pink shoes and pink tights were made to represent European skin. But what Dance Theater of Harlem, what they're known for is that they created a dance company for dancers of color, for Black dancers, and we're not pink. You need to have the proper brown, the proper nude. But anyway, that was the origin of, you know, one of the emotional origins of why I started Nude Bar, because that was so embarrassing. And I felt like I couldn't recover from that all year, because everybody remembered me as the girl that showed up in the tan tights and wasn't in the proper uniform. And so anyway, I went through life having to do this whole science project in my kitchen, dyeing my tights every week, you know, making sure I had enough for the week, putting makeup foundation on my shoes with a makeup sponge, doing this every week because you have to replenish the shoes and the tights regularly. And even, you know, when I would do other jobs like commercials or, you know, other forms of dance, everyone would be complaining about this all the time. Like every day, people were like, why do we have to do this pancaking? Da, da, da. Why don't the bigger manufacturers make it? And I was like, yeah, why don't they? Why don't I just do it? So that's how I got here.
That's incredible. I mean, Wow, what a personal pain point. Certainly one that is grounded in a very emotional story. I know, like, things that happen when you're younger too, like, stick with you. You probably still remember, like, that feeling of sitting out. Like, I remember small embarrassing points in my life, and I wish they had turned into business ideas. But no, I can totally see how this would drive you to build Nude Bar. You know, as you were starting to build this, it feels like you just wanted to at least solve your problem, right? Like, let's see if I can source a manufacturer that will create this in the shades that would reflect me or my peers. As you were starting, was this a, I'm going to build a big business, or was it, I'm going to solve this problem first? How did you think about that?
Yeah, so ultimately, I did want to build a big business. However, I didn't go to business school. I have a BFA, Bachelor of Fine Arts in ballet. But I always thought that, you know, with my minor in business management, I would just open a dance school or start a agency or something that was in the arts, was where my mind was with that. You know, but ultimately, when I started Nude Bar, I had no idea what I was doing. I'd never manufactured anything. I didn't know where to start. I was very lost in the beginning, but I figured I would start it as a lifestyle business first, solving the problem, selling to my dancer friends, my network first, and then figure out how to make it a big business. But I did always have the long-term vision that this would be a big business.
Got it. Do you remember any turning points or things that made you realize that, oh, I need to raise money for this, or that I'm going to be able to raise money for this? Like, were there sort of pivotal moments within the growth of the business that sort of put you on a different trajectory?
Several, for sure. Okay. But, you know, the first one was really that, so I had this idea in my head, you know, I told my parents first, obviously, like, you know, that thing that I'm always doing in the kitchen and that I'm always complaining about, I think I should build a business around that. I think that's the thing. I think that's a problem to solve. And so then there was a question of, okay, how the heck do we do it? So I just started telling other friends, like close friends. One conversation led to a friend of mine was actually in business school and was like, oh, you should meet my mentor. He's starting an incubator in New York City for entrepreneurs, and maybe he can help point you in the right direction. So it turns out that this guy was a professor at NYU Polytech in entrepreneurship in the entrepreneur department. And so he like helped me pretty much put together my first pitch deck, and they didn't have any women or people of color in the incubator at the time. So I kind of checked those boxes, but I still didn't have any capital. He did help me come up with like a target list of investors to pitch. And this was in 2009. So I incorporated the company in 2009 and then spent 2009 to like late 2011 figuring out how the heck do I pull this off. So a part of that was meeting this guy, and he did get me in front of a few angel investors. He's like, yeah, we need to raise at least $100,000. And like, I think that was the number we were anchoring on, just to kind of get like those initial batches of inventory and, you know, hire a couple people, whatever. None of those pitches were successful. First of all, I was pitching white dudes all the time. And no one understood the problem that I was solving. They were just like, well, I don't get it. They didn't have any emotional connection the way that I did to, you know, the problem. And they had this perspective of, well, if no one's solving this problem, it must not be a big enough problem to solve. So that way I, you know, got all the no's in the world, you know, at least in that time. But I did pitch this one woman angel investor, and she said to me, you know, I think that it's so early, you need to basically have proof of concept for people to get this. And I think you just need to build this out of your apartment with as minimal money as you can. Like, I think you need to think of a model for that and then come back to pitching investors. So I decided to do that. So at that time, I was dancing for the Knicks. I was teaching bar fitness classes, usually like evenings and weekends. I also assigned to an agency for, you know, dance and commercials and things like that.
So you had a lot of free time.
Yeah, I had tons of free time and so much money, you know, just living the artist life. But I booked this commercial for American Airlines, and it was a union commercial. I was getting residual checks every month for it. So I saved up like $3,000 of residual check money. And that's what I started the business on.
When we come back, how Erin was able to build momentum from her $3,000 rainy day fund. I spend most of my days one-on-one with entrepreneurs, helping them understand strategies that make a difference in fundraising. Some things vary from founder to founder because not everyone's story is the same. One thing I'm super consistent about, no matter who the founder, is making sure they send their decks and materials using a document sharing tool. And for that, I always recommend DocSend. DocSend lets you know what's happening with your deck after you send it along, with real-time analytics and notifications. Did the VCs actually open it? What slides did they spend the most time on? And if you think it got shared with the wrong people, or maybe you made a mistake and sent it too quickly, DocSend lets you control access and make updates to content even after sending. Sign up for a free 2-week trial at docsend.com/funded. That's docsend.com/funded. Okay, back to the show. We heard before the break, Erin was able to set aside $3,000 to get her business off the ground. But it turns out $3,000 doesn't get you quite that far off the ground. You found $3,000 to put into the company. What did you put that capital, that first injection of capital, to use for? Was it just inventory or?
Yeah, it was literally just inventory. And I mean, honestly, if you break down the fact that we had 18 skin tone colors in the brand, now we have 12, but we had 18 at the time. You have multiple sizes. Like, you need way more money than $3,000, basically is what I'm saying. And so anyway, I figured out, you know, some ways to do that and to get scrappy. So I literally just bought my first batch of tights, and I wrote down a list of 100 dancers that I knew that I thought would buy the product. After writing down that list of 100, I'm like, yeah, all these 100 dancers are gonna buy the tights, and then that's gonna buy me my next batch. And of course that didn't happen. None of your friends buy your products in the beginning, turns out, you know. But anywho, so, you know, I got a handful of dancers to buy the products. I started cold emailing NFL and NBA dance teams. So I ended up getting a couple of NFL teams to buy the product in bulk. And also early in 2012, I sent a package to Wendy Williams, the talk show host, to her studio, because it's like on her website, and wrote a letter about who I am, what I'm doing, why I'm doing it. She was wearing a luxury brand of hosiery at the time. And then one day, like a couple weeks after sending her that package, her wardrobe assistant called and said, hey, just wanted to give you a heads up that in 5 minutes, Wendy's about to go on the show live with your product on. She's been actually wearing them all week and loves them, but wanted to make sure you're available in an hour so we can get all of the details so we can post it on our website and social. And then we wanted to place an order after the show. So I'm like, what?
Whoa.
Yeah. And so that just really, that was a really big pivotal moment for us. I mean, we had like a landing page, like not even a functional e-commerce website, really, because I was literally selling these things like tight by tight. Like every audition I was going on, I had a luggage of tights that I was dragging around, like door-to-door salesperson style, like asking other dancers, hey, at this company, you got these little swatches so you can match yourself. Like I was like really, you know, scrappy. And there was no marketing budget, you know. There was no, I mean, and even then there was no like Instagram, that all of that. So anyway, that was really exciting that Wendy wanted to wear the product. But back then, what was really cool is before influencers was such a an industry. She was our first influencer. So she would post on social every day what she was wearing, mentioning all the brands and the products that she was wearing. So it would say Nude Bar Fishnets, you know, with tagging us on Twitter, blah, blah, blah. And then she also did this on her website. So this got us at the time, like 60% of our traffic was like from her website. Our phones were ringing. Like I had, you know, a Nude Bar cell phone that people would be calling. Yeah, I saw your tights on the Wendy show and wanted to order some. So I was taking phone orders and all of this.
One, that's a very cool story. And two, I just wanted to interject, like, the whole scrappiness that you describe is really impressive to hear. And you know, you were doing something in e-commerce, but I hear this a lot in companies that think they have a software idea and they're like, well, I'm trying to raise money. I need to raise money to even show traction to these investors, to show people things. And they're asking for validation and they're asking for data that just doesn't exist. I need the money before mm-hmm. I can do anything. I need to hire engineers. And you know, you could have said, how am I supposed to show that people want this? I need to like buy a ton of inventory and I need money to develop an e-commerce platform to even sell it so that I can show them that people want it. But as I tell other people and as you did, it's like there are things that you can do without capital. I mean, it's certainly not easier, but like can go out and, you know, hit the pavement, press the flesh, talk to people, cold email people. Even if you were just able to get their sort of verbal request for a product, like that would be even different than just plain pitching people, I have this idea, I think it'll be great. So I love that example of, I mean, you actually built the product, but you were, you know, selling tight by tight to just show interest. And then of course, I think like hard work creates luck and hard work creates like opportunity. And so Wendy Williams was a great little pivotal moment for there. So it sounds like you're building up a little momentum. Mm-hmm. And there is this tough game in growing e-commerce companies, I think. Like, you can only grow so fast bootstrapping, right? You're, like, buying inventory and then getting a little bit more revenue, and that cycle is so tight. And you had to be thinking, how do I get more money? How do I grow faster with this? What was the next decision point around fundraising, like, where you felt like you had both the story to tell, the thing that you could point to in terms of revenue, and like the full, like, oh, I need this money today. Like, we need to go get it.
Yeah. I think I was always in the mindset that we need the money today. Like every day I felt that
how
way.
How am I still doing this? Yeah. Without money. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was like a thing. And I mean, and the way that I was bootstrapping was like, I was still performing. I was still teaching bar classes and doing this. And then I did kind of hit a point where it was like, I had to choose where my time was growing. Like, the business had grown to a certain point where I needed to put more hours in, essentially, versus kind of just doing it for a couple hours a day when I had some free time. But at the same time, it's like those other things that I was doing were paying my bills, right? But how do you transition? Like, I can't afford to pay myself a salary at where we were at, type of a thing. So that was, you know, pitching and just like finding the ability to raise money was always on my mind. I was always open to taking meetings and pitching, but I was still getting no's 100%. Like, there was no outside capital coming in. So I guess to kind of shorten the story, you know, I didn't bring in my first outside capital or investor money until like 2019. So from 2009, when I incorporated, launched in late 2011, 2012, got Wendy Williams on, got a little bit of a boost. No outside capital came in until 2019.
Wow, Erin, that is super impressive to stick with. I mean, I hope other investors are going to be listening to this, but like, this is the kind of dedication and passion for what you're doing that investors look for. Like, That is literally hitting your head against the wall for 10 years and keeping it going because, you know, there was an opportunity there. So kudos for all of that.
Or I'm just crazy. I don't know.
or you're just crazy. I, you know, I wanted to stay away from, you know, pointing that out, but I often have to do that with founders. So, well, let's talk about 2019. Can you set the stage? What happened in 2019 that sort of started shifting things?
Yeah. So, you know, in 2018, I'll back up a little bit. I was pregnant with my little one. So, you know, as I was bootstrapping in that transition from performing to, you know, actually being more full-time into the business. I was teaching bar still because it was, you know, it paid really well and I can do like a couple hours a day. So I was teaching about 20 classes a week, wow, you know, up until I was about 35, 36 weeks pregnant. You usually deliver. So maybe I'm crazy. But anyway, so I was doing that and I was like, yeah, I can't keep doing this many classes and I'm going to have a baby soon and like need to figure this out. So I, you know, I'd been pitching a lot throughout that entire pregnancy, you know, trying to raise more capital, still getting the no's. But one really cool thing that happened in the pregnancy was I was getting these anonymous orders that turned out to be Serena Williams. And she...
What? Wait, wait. Yeah, you really yada yada yada'd over that. What do you mean? Like?
So yeah, I was getting these orders on the website and it turns out that they were from Serena Williams.
Oh, she was like mystery buying.
Mystery buying, yeah. And was wearing our product throughout her 2018 tennis season. So once I found out that it was her, my dad is like on ESPN. He's like, yeah, I think when they zoom in, I see that she has on these nude fishnets. I'm pretty sure they're your tights. Turns out, wow, that they were. I mean, she was wearing them in Wimbledon and, you know, whole season. So cool. So anyway, we get to the end of the season, towards the end, and her team contacted me because we sold out of the SKU that she was buying. And so the question was, okay, when are you going to restock this? Because, like, we're wearing these. And I'm like, well, the challenge is that once we sell out of something, I have to scrape together enough money to replenish that SKU. And at the time, as a bootstrap company, there was no specific timeline for when that would happen, right? So it's just when I have enough money, then I replenish it. So, you know, what I did tell her team is that, well, I'm actually fundraising to scale the business because this is a challenge of ours to keep up with the inventory, the demand. And so it turns out that she's an investor. And so they said, oh, actually, we're doing a pitch competition and partnership with the Bumble Fund, with Bumble, the dating app. So they're like, you should apply. I'm like, oh, this is going to be BS. I have to apply for this competition. Hundreds of people, thousands of people are going to apply. Like, you know, I just assumed they were blowing me off. I end up becoming a finalist. I fly out to meet both Whitney Wolf Heard from Bumble and Serena Williams, pitch them in person, and I become one of the winners of the competition. And they are my first two checks in, my first ever outside capital into the company, which ended up being in 2019.
Wow. So yeah, you were one of the last people to raise money in a pre-pandemic world.
Totally.
So that was a pitch competition style.
Yes.
On stage, was it, or in front of an audience?
No, they actually decided to do it more intimate. So we like sat down in like kind of like a library kind of setting, you know, like a lounge kind of setting. One of the things that they wanted to accomplish in this pitch competition is that as a founder pitching investors, it feels like a very threatening environment. Like, answer all these questions and, you know, and then you feel like, oh my God, did I get it wrong? Is this a trick? Are they asking me? Like, you know, it doesn't feel, you know, like we're peers, if you will. And founders should feel that this is an opportunity, right? This is an opportunity for the investor to make money. This person shouldn't be talking down to you. And so they had experienced that a lot in their careers and they wanted to change the experience of pitching. So they wanted this to feel like, we're girlfriends talking on a couch. Just tell me about your awesome business. And so that's what the pitch was. It was just sitting on a couch, chatting and telling them about my business.
What an amazing opportunity to just be able to sit down like Serena Williams and Whitney Wolf Heard are your girlfriends, you know, like, yeah, two very impressive women who you probably looked up to.
Yeah, totally.
That's great. So how long did that last, or how long until you had to go raise money again? I assume this wasn't like, you know, run for 3 years type of capital. Was just a little bit of a boost to start feeling what it was like being a venture backed company.
Yeah. So, you know, it was, I would say that the check sizes were more like angel check sizes, you know, just to, I guess, to make it make more sense. So I was still like pavement fundraising, basically still getting a lot of no's because the challenge, again, we were at the time we were at a point where like, our inventory was pretty depleted. So there wasn't a lot that we could do to like ramp up the revenue. And, you know, it was enough money to get us some inventory, but there's still like months that it takes to make it and then ship it and all of that. So there was just kind of this window of not a lot happening in the business, or being able to prove that there's this huge momentum happening, if that makes sense. So anyway, fast forward, there was some interest in like at least having meetings with me. I ended up getting introduced to another founder who, you know, her business was like really booming. She was also in the underwear intimate space, had raised like $13 million or something crazy in VC funding. So I was introduced to her and was just like, how the heck did you do that? And then she told me about one of her investors, Jason Calacanis, and said, do you want to meet him? Yes. So she made an introduction. Jason and his fund launch ended up being my third check-in, and which was pretty pivotal as well. So, I mean, between those three names really kind of helped us. So I went through his accelerator program called Launch, which is mainly focused around just like pitching and fundraising for the most part. There is a growth component, but the majority of the focus is on fundraising. So at the end of that accelerator, which was in the middle of the pandemic, I think we only did like 3 weeks in person before the pandemic, and then the rest of the accelerator was virtual and in the middle of the pandemic. At the end of the program, then I ended up officially raising, like closing out the full round, which ended up being my Series Seed.
Okay, before we get into the results of that, I just wanted to pick apart one small thing because I think there might be some learning opportunities for founders. You talked about meeting another founder that was just in the space for a conversation. And I find that a lot of founders don't realize the value of meeting people and meeting people that know people and trying to like figure out your way through the world with these little lily pads that you jump to. We've never spoken about this, but do you have like a sense, why did you even take that call? Did you have like a very specific strategy to meet this woman, or like, was it just one of those things that happened?
No, it's one of those things that happen. I think the one thing that I have learned from this journey is you just never know. Like you literally, like you just, you don't know. And so even meeting her, it was actually through, we now share the same lawyer. And at first I was like, not sure I wanted to take the call with the lawyer. The lawyer knew somebody that I knew and was like, oh, this person wants to meet you. Do you want to meet this lawyer? And I'm like, oh, she's just going to sell me on being my lawyer because now I got this funding. Like, it's probably not going to go anywhere, but I was like, I'll just see what happens. So I met that person, and that lawyer then was like, oh, let me introduce you to, like, rattled off a bunch of people and just wanted to be helpful. So my lawyer, she really is passionate about helping female founders and just wanted to be helpful in the beginning. Like, you got this new funding, like, let's just talk about it. Like, how can I be helpful for you to raise the next round? Or like, what is the game plan? What are you doing, basically? She then introduced me to that founder, and I came prepared to the meeting with a list of things of like, I'm struggling with all these things. How are you doing this? How are you accomplishing it? And she answered all of the questions. And that was like game changer.
Was the Series Seed the last round that you raised?
Yeah. So the Series Seed was the last round for $1.4 million. And, you know, I'm fundraising now, to everybody out there.
Great.
I'm fundraising now. So, yeah, I mean, that was very exciting getting like that first big money in, essentially. Yeah. And just, you know, really building out the team in a real way, getting all the inventory we needed. Like, that period of time was just like, oh my gosh, it's really happening, finally.
Yeah. And who ended up leading that round fully?
It was led by Freestyle Capital, and then co-led by Jason. Yeah.
That's a great fund to have on board. As you think about, you know, going through Jason's training around fundraising and actually closing that out, what are some of the things that you learned about executing a better fundraise that as you look back on your 10 previous years of bootstrapping, like, are there things that you're like, that you know now, like what are some of the things that like were big in terms of unlocks for you around what it means to be better at fundraising?
One thing to note is that although my personal story comes from being a dancer, you know, majority of our customers are actually everyday women. There is a large portion of our customers that are the dancers, entertainers, athletes, but majority of them are everyday women. And so being able to articulate that to investors to really show that like it's a huge market. Every person needs underwear of some sort, right? And that's what we make. We make we make basic foundational undergarments. This isn't like a fashion trend or anything like that. These are kind of like your day-to-day essentials for women. But being able to tell that story, I mean, day one with Jason, like he sat there with you with the clicker, like going through each slide. Yep, take that, like really meticulously going through your deck, like take this out, take that out, move it around. And every week that we would pitch, he'd give you more notes and give you more notes and give you more edits. So by the end of it, like we were really great at pitching. And even now that I'm like back out pitching, I'm like, I feel like I need to go through his workshop again, you know, because I was so polished at that time, like really working with him and his team on getting it tight. And then the other perspective was just like the follow-up with investors and how to, the training on how to answer questions. He would explain to us, when you say it this way, when you answer the question this way, this communicates to the investor this. I want you to communicate this. So he would help us kind of reword the way we would answer things, which was really helpful. And then just having, you know, that follow up with investors, sending updates regularly, even if they did say no, you know, you could turn a no into a yes eventually if you can give the right updates.
No, there's so much nuance and detail in fundraising that I think a first time fundraiser doesn't understand. It's like you're telling your personal story, which is very compelling, but needing to connect it to a big vision, a big opportunity is like something that you founders might not like naturally think about, but someone like Jason Calcanis or myself, when I hear someone pitching, I'm like, all you need to do is just add this one little thing and it will like explode the opportunity in an investor's mind of like, oh, it's not just women of color dancing for professional sports teams. Wow, that's such a small, you know, small population. It's everyday women. And like, wow, how big is that market?
Right.
And then the other thing you said, I think is so important to hear, is that investors are making decisions to invest millions of dollars in an incredibly short amount of time. And so they're reacting to every little bit of communication and drawing, like extrapolating and perceiving it in different ways. And I think it's great that, you know, Jason helps founders think through what exactly they're communicating with, even very short emails.
Yeah. And I think also it was helpful, like he'll tell you, like, you're good at this. Like he'll kind of be able to say to you, and it was different for everyone in our cohort, you know, this is what stands out for your company. So like hone in on that, talk about those details, and even just figuring out what metrics, because I kind of struggle with that. Like, well, what metrics should I have in the deck that are meaningful to investors? Like, is it this? Is it that? I mean, there's lots of things you can pull, but like what matters, you know, what will get an investor excited?
When we come back, Erin on a tip she picked up from an accelerator on how to get pitch ready. Early on at my last company, we had the chance to sell into a large public company, but ran into a wall. They wouldn't work with us unless we were SOC 2 certified. We really tried for weeks to get something done. We were Googling how to get SOC 2 certified and interviewing expensive consultants. But in the end, we abandoned the deal because it was too distracting. So when I learned about Vanta, a company that was just backed by Sequoia, used by hundreds of SaaS startups to get SOC 2 certified, I was so annoyed. I mean, I really wish they had been around back then. Vanta makes it super easy to get a variety of certifications like ISO 27001, SOC 2, the certification we needed to get, and HIPAA. They integrate with your cloud provider and other tools you already use to automate the super complex and time-consuming process of preparing for an audit. Anyway, if you'd like to drop a months-long process down to weeks like I would have back then and actually sign those major contracts, you should check out Vanta. Also, I'm really happy to share that listeners of Funded get hooked up. You all can get $1,000 off your service by going to vanta.com/funded. That's vanta.com/funded. Okay, back to the show. By now, I'm sure you've picked up that Erin's story is really powerful. I couldn't have been the only one who's moved by that memory of being asked to sit out of rehearsal as a kid. But as she's about to tell you, it took a lot of work to mold that emotional narrative into a pitch that worked.
For fundraising specific and pitching, I'll record myself doing the pitch and I'll watch it back. That's another thing that I was doing that even a little bit before the accelerator, but in the accelerator, they would record us pitching every week and give it to us so that we can see, like, what do you sound like? What's your body language? Like, what words are you kind of using over and over again that maybe don't make sense? Or, you know, you may say, think that you're saying something in a way when you're in live in the moment, and then you listen to it and you're like, gosh, what was I saying there? So that was even helpful, and just like concise sentences, specific sentences. So I do that. I do that regularly when, you know, I'm about to pitch. I do like a rehearsal, a tech rehearsal, as we would call it in the industry, where I record myself and then I'll watch it back.
Yeah, I think practice is so important in pitching. So if you're a nervous founder that doesn't think they're good at pitching, you need to practice. Like every practice, every rep will make you better. And then I also find that some founders that think they're really good have an overblown sense of how good they actually are, and they'll only figure that out if they practice and get feedback. So I love that you shared that.
And even practicing the questions, because like, I also have a notebook of my pitches, and I'll write down like, what did people ask me, and then see what were the common threads, like what are like the top three questions, and then I rehearse those to get sharp on those answers. Because if I don't nail those top three questions, then I'm probably losing the investor, right? If I can't nail it.
I think that's right. Do you remember when Freestyle decided to invest? Do you remember like the moment that they either sent you an email or called you to tell you that that was happening? Was that something that stands out in your memory?
Yeah, that was over Zoom. Dave is the partner that we work with at Freestyle. And I think he shot me an email. Maybe he texted me like, hey, are you free right now? Just for like a quick call. And I'm like, okay. We hop on a Zoom and he's like, okay, well, I know I told you I'd get you an answer in 10 days and it's been like 11 or 12 or something like that. So just wanted to get back to you. And then he's like, yeah, so we would like to lead the round. And he, you know, told me the check size and the terms. And we kind of had a little bit of back and forth on that. And yeah, I mean, it was, I got off the Zoom and I was like, oh my God, did that just happen?
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
That must've just been like a wave of relief and joy just washing over you.
Yeah. And I was like visiting my parents. You know, this was in the pandemic. I mean, my toddler was probably downstairs screaming and running around. And so it was just very exciting.
That was my conversation with Erin Carpenter, founder of Nude Bar, the tights and bodywear brand worn by amazing women like Wendy Williams, Tyra Banks, Beyonce, and Serena Williams. With all that amazing support, my producer Olivia was curious why Erin would need to bootstrap. That was one of the things we tackled in our debrief.
Okay, hi.
Hi, hi.
You ready?
I am pretty ready.
So, okay, where I wanted to start today is the topic of bootstrapping, because it's something that has come up a little bit, but I can't quite tell, when do people bootstrap?
It's a really good question and something for us to unpack on a number of different levels. This is not a clean answer. So the idea of bootstrapping is just pulling yourself up by your boots, I guess the straps of your boots. Mm-hmm. I guess that's where it comes from. And it essentially refers to entrepreneurs that use whatever resources they have available to them themselves without getting outside funding in order to run their business. And that could mean, you know, investing whatever's in their bank account to not really investing any money and just starting to run the business and generating revenue from that and then reinvesting those revenues back into the business. Now, the idea of, you know, why would a founder ever bootstrap has a lot of different answers. So I thought it was a really good learning moment for everyone to hear what Erin's process was like. She wasn't bootstrapping by choice. Like she believed she could build a big business that could take on investor capital and return a multiple, but she just couldn't convince anyone to give her money. Like for 10 years, we heard she couldn't get people to get on board. And so for her, it wasn't by choice. She wanted to raise money, but she needed to continue to build the business. One, to keep the dream alive, but two, to continue creating proof points and growth in the business to make it a much more compelling story for investors to come in. And so the two things that I'd point out there is that depending on how good of a storyteller you are or how much your story is resonating, you may or may not need to generate numbers or traction in order to raise that initial round of capital. But for a variety of reasons, Erin wasn't able to. So she just, you know, put her nose to the grindstone and rolled up her sleeves and actually continued to build the business, sell, get celebrity partners on, until finally, you know, she had enough of a fulsome story to go raise money. Now, other people bootstrap by choice. And the choice of bootstrapping before you raise money is to say, well, yes, I could raise money now, but, and people are offering, or I know that I could get that money, but if I run the business myself with my own capital for as long as I can, the further along it goes, the larger the business gets, the higher valuation I'll be able to get when I actually do go out and raise money and then sell less of my company, give less of my company away when I end up taking investors on. So those are kind of two scenarios. One is the unintentional bootstrapping, or the bootstrapping not by choice. And the other one is the intentional bootstrapping, trying to push the business along as far as you can until you raise capital.
Just to get specific here, I'm wondering, can you remember the last person who came to you for advice, or the last person who pitched you and wanted you to invest? Can you remember the last one of those people who you actually recommended bootstrapping to? And you don't have to name names. I want an example of like a scenario in which bootstrapping might be useful.
Honestly, it's a common conversation that you have with the founder of how far can you get without raising money? Because at the earliest stages, like when someone's like, I just have this idea, I want to go raise money for it, I'm often encouraging people to bootstrap, even if it's just for another month or, you know, another experiment. Because the thing I see a lot is founders who are like, especially first-time founders who are like, I have this cool idea about this business, I want to go raise money to go do it. And what they don't realize is there's like so much validation, so much work that could be done without money that would not only make their investor pitch, their story much more attractive, but it would kind of de-risk what they were doing for themselves. Like a lot of first-time founders just have ideas and don't know whether or not there's a real opportunity there. And you can save a lot of heartache by putting in the work without money to validate, to talk to customers, to understand what the actual problem is, if it's large enough for someone to pay for. So the short answer is I tell first-time founders all the time, or at least have the discussion, like, do you have any opportunity to continue running this without raising money? Because you probably should for a little bit longer. So it is a very common thing. You know, I guess the last thing I'd say is sometimes you could bootstrap and you just see an opportunity to move faster. And so getting investor capital, even though you could run it without investor capital, is just a means to go faster.
Okay, where else do you want to take this?
I thought it was very like moving almost to hear Erin describe the starting point of her company and the challenges she faced, or like the problems she faced.
Like that she was working multiple jobs and stuff like that, or?
Actually, I think like the thing that I look for in a lot of founders is this story where she was like, when I joined the Harlem Dance Troupe or whatever, when I joined dance company, and they told me go buy nude tights, and I showed up and, you know, the tights that I bought didn't match the color of my skin. It was so embarrassing. They told me to sit out.
How do you think that resonated in pitch meetings? I mean, it obviously resonated with me. Maybe I'm just a bleeding heart or something, but what do you think investors made out of that?
Yeah, well, personally, I mean, when I heard her telling the story and thinking about what that must have felt like as a young person, I kind of got it just because I have, you know, I myself have a really bad memory, but weirdly, there are two or three moments in my, grade school and high school, just incredibly embarrassing moments that are seared into my memory. And so that really stuck with me in terms of something that is driving her, because I think in her head she's like, I'm not the only one that this has happened to. Like, I'm not the only one, either be it in dance rehearsal or just wanting to fit in and, have tights that make sense for me. I'm not the only black and brown girl that has felt that. And so to me, that could be a very compelling story to tell, because you want to know that the founder has really great reasons or powerful reasons to want to solve the problem and want to continue pushing forward. That if she goes through a week of bad sales, like things aren't working for whatever reason, she's never going to question whether or not there are people that have this problem. She's like, I just know, I know in my heart of hearts, I remember being that girl being asked to sit out of class, and I know it's a problem. And so those type of personal stories, I think, are actually really powerful for founders, for investors to hear. So, yeah, I imagine, that was part of the story that she told as she pitched.
Okay, I've got a question.
Yeah,
Sorry.
please.
Okay, who is this Jason Calacanis guy? I feel like he's come up once before. He seems to be a big deal. Do I have that right?
Jason Calacanis is a very successful angel investor. He famously was one of the first Sequoia scouts. So Sequoia is a big venture capital firm that would give small bits of money to entrepreneurs, people that have access to great deals, to invest on their behalf. And he, I think, very famously put like $50,000 into the angel round of Uber, which turned into many, 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 many millions of dollars. He has since made other successful angel bets that have really put him on the map. And he now runs an accelerator program called Launch, which I actually didn't realize was incredibly focused on fundraising, something, near and dear to my heart. But it makes sense. I think he has been an entrepreneur himself. He has raised money himself. He has been an investor himself. And so that combination of experiences allows him to help a bunch of founders at once and put them through training that I think makes a huge difference in ability to actually fundraise.
So that was how, after 10 years, she was able to raise money, right?
Yeah, so the timeline was that after 10 years, she finally landed Serena Williams and
So cool.
Whitney Wolf. And then alongside them, she also got into Jason Calacanis's accelerator program. And then from there, she launched a more formal fundraise and landed Freestyle as her lead investor alongside Jason Calacanis.
Wow, super sick.
Yeah, and so now she's off to the races. I'm really excited to see what they do. By the way, I asked Erin if she had any other big name customers, and it turns out Serena Williams was just the beginning.
Another one of our customers is Laverne Cox, and she was also kind of like, I kept seeing this name pop up on the website for a while, and then eventually looked at him and was like, oh, that's how I know this name. So she's, people mostly know her from The Orange Is the New Black,
Yeah.
as a transgender actress and performer. But her, and then others will just come to us directly, or again through my, network in the entertainment industry. So Doja Cat is one of our customers now.
Oh, fun.
So she and SZA, at the most recent Billboard Awards, wore nude bar tights.
Thanks so much for listening. There are tons of insights that each founder we cover on Funded has around startups, fundraising, and life, and we don't have time to cover it all. So if you'd like to get a free insights pack based on Eric and Carpenter from Nude Bar, go to fundedpod.com/nudebar. If you're looking for more insights, strategies, and support around fundraising, here are a few things you should do. Definitely subscribe to our newsletter at fundedpod.com/newsletter and find me on social. I'm at JA. That's JAYYEH on almost every platform. I respond to newsletter replies and DMs, so hit me up. This episode was produced by Olivia Reingold.
Hello.
Thanks also to Jono Lee from Adamant Ventures.
Hello, friends.
And thanks to Aaron for showing us what a real-life superhero looks like. I still can't get over the number of jobs she juggled while having her child and going out to fundraise. Jeez. As always, one last thanks to our fantastic sponsor, DocSend, the most trusted document sharing platform.